The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon. From King Features. Lyme symptoms puzzling to doctors. Question. I was bitten by a tick in July 2007. Though that led to infection with Lyme disease, the doctor misdiagnosed me and prescribed prednisone. After 3 months, I was much worse. The next doctor I saw made the correct diagnosis and treated me with 30 days of doxycycline. The Western blot test was still positive after my antibiotic course, although my doctor said I was cured because I had the dose of antibiotics recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Over the next decade, I struggled with worsening symptoms. Two more doctors said I was cured and that the fatigue, pain, and other problems all were in my head. Eventually, an infectious disease doctor agreed that I had chronic Lyme disease. I was treated for a year with doxycycline and azithromycin, doxycycline for the active form bacteria, and azithromycin for the dormant cyst form. I have been mostly pain-free since then. Have there been any changes in the way Lyme disease is diagnosed and treated so others won't have to suffer as I did? Answer. Lyme disease remains one of the most controversial and challenging infections that patients experience. According to the CDC, as many as 300,000 Americans contract this tick-borne disease annually. Early symptoms of Lyme disease include fever, chills, headache, and sometimes rash. Typically, this would take a bull's eye appearance, but it's not always present. Fatigue and pain in muscles and joints is common. Treatment with an antibiotic is most effective in the early stages of Lyme infection, but the standard diagnostic tests are not very accurate during the first several weeks. As a result, some doctors in areas where Lyme disease is common begin antibiotic treatment even before the test results are available. Physicians have been baffled by people who continue to suffer arthritis, brain fog, fatigue, and other symptoms long after they have completed treatment. A recent estimate predicts that this total might soon reach almost 2 million people. That's from the BMC Public Health, April 24, 2019. New diagnostic approaches will use genomic techniques to identify the infection early when it can be treated most successfully. Hornet stings alleviate plantar fasciitis pain. Question. You have written in the past about bee or hornet stings easing pain. I have been battling plantar fasciitis for over a year. 2 days ago, I stepped on a hornet's nest and got more than 15 stings. This was unpleasant, to say the least. Amazingly, though, the next day I woke up with no plantar fasciitis pain. This topic should be explored more deeply. Answer. Most of the research on stings has been focused on preventing or treating dangerous allergic responses to bee stings. However, hornet venom is similar in many ways. Surprisingly, animal research suggests that some insect venom can have anti-inflammatory activity and ease pain, cited in the journal Immunopharmacology and Immunotoxicology, April 2015. This may explain why bee venom has been used for arthritis for thousands of years in Ayurvedic medicine. You can learn more about apitherapy, and other non-drug strategies for relieving pain in our e-guide to alternatives for arthritis. This online resource is available at www.peoplespharmacy.com. Some people are allergic to bee, hornet, and wasp stings. For them, such an accident could be life-threatening. Question. For years, I was susceptible to cold sores from stress, sun exposure, and eating too much sugary food. In my early 30s, I was picking up a prescription for acyclovir ointment my dentist prescribed for cold sore. The pharmacist told me to take daily doses of the amino acid L-lysine. Once I started taking the L-lysine, my cold sores stopped almost completely. I hardly get them anymore, although I know I still have the virus in my system. Answer. We have heard from many other readers that L-lysine supplements can help prevent the development of cold sores. There is, unfortunately, little research on the use of this amino acid as a cold sore remedy. However, a review concluded that in combination with a low arginine diet, high doses of L-lysine can prevent lesion reoccurrences, and that's cited in the journal Integrative Medicine, June 2017. We would like to see large, well-controlled, long-term trials to assess the success of this approach. However, there's little, if any, financial incentive for a drug company to conduct such a research. From the New York Times, sesame allergy more common in America than once thought. At least 1 million children and adults in the United States are allergic to sesame, an ingredient used in everything from hummus to snack bars, researchers reported recently. The finding indicates that sesame allergy is more prevalent than previously known, although still far less common than peanut allergy. But sesame is not among the allergens that the Food and Drug Administration requires manufacturers to list on food labels. Sesame allergy is becoming a common allergy in the United States, said Dr. Ruchi S. Gupta, a professor of pediatric at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago, and senior author of the study, which was published in the journal JAMA Network Open. The impact on over 1 million people in the U.S. is significant. The study relied on online and phone survey responses from 40,453 adults and 38,408 children. People who have had at least one symptom of sesame allergy made up an estimated 0.23% of the population, Gupta and her colleagues found. Those who have been diagnosed with the allergy but have never experienced a symptom accounted for an estimated 0.11% of the population. That's about 1.1 million people in the U.S. who currently probably have a sesame allergy and therefore avoiding sesame in their daily lives, says Christopher M. Warren, an epidemiologist at the Northwestern Center for Food Allergy and Asthma Research and lead author of the study. Exposure to a food allergen like sesame can lead to an anaphylactic reaction, including throat swelling and a drop in blood pressure. Severe reactions can be fatal. Many people in the survey reported symptoms of sesame allergy, but were never actually diagnosed, Gupta noted. If you eat a food and have a reaction, it is important to get it diagnosed because you want to make sure it really is an allergy to that food before you spend your life avoiding that food, she said. From the Wall Street Journal by Joe Craven McGinty, sunscreen saves lives. What else does it do? There's always a but. Sunscreens protect against the harmful effect of ultraviolet radiation, but regulators don't know the extent to which the over-the-counter drugs make it into the bloodstream or what happens to the body when they do. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration wants to know, and if its proposed rule asking manufacturers to provide the information is finalized in November, as planned, some ingredients now used to prevent sunburn may be removed from the market. The number one thing we're asking for is the absorption data, said Teresa Michelle, director of the FDA's Division of Non-Prescription Drug Products. It stands to reason if you're slathering yourself with a drug, one question you should ask is how much of that drug gets through the skin and into the body. In the past, the skin was believed to be largely impermeable, Dr. Michelle said, but the medical community now knows that isn't the case. Some products, such as nicotine and estrogen patches, even use skin as a delivery mechanism, counting on its ability to absorb the drugs. In addition, sunscreens are now worn routinely by both children and adults, contributing concerns about their safety, according to David Andrews, a senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group. a nonprofit research organization that rates sunscreens and other products. In the U.S., at least 16 minerals and chemicals may be used as active ingredients in sunscreens. The FDA's proposed rule rates the minerals zinc oxide and titanium oxide safe and effective. It doesn't recognize PABA, P-A-B-A, or trolamine salicylate as safe, and it concludes there is too little information to determine whether the 12 other chemicals are safe. According to the FDA, if the ingredients are absorbed into the bloodstream at a level of 0.5 nanograms per milliliter or higher, they should be tested to determine if they increase the risk of cancer, birth defects, or other adverse effects. In a pilot study, four active ingredients in four commercially available sunscreens exceeded this threshold. The results were published in May in the peer-reviewed Journal of the American Medical Association. The study, conducted by the FDA and Spalding Clinical Research, is testing a testing facility in West Bend, Wisconsin, randomly assigned 24 healthy participants to use one of four sunscreens, including two sprays, one lotion, and one cream. The researchers found that concentrations of each active ingredient exceeded the testing threshold after only one day. The primary target of the study was avobenzone, which blocks UVA and UVB rays and is one of the most commonly used chemical ingredients in sunscreen. The four sunscreens each contain 3% avobenzone, the highest percentage allowed by the regulatory standard. The substance was found in the bloodstream at average concentrations of 4.0 and 3.4 nanograms per milliliter for participants using the sprays, 4.3 for those using the lotion, and 1.8 for those using the cream. Three other active ingredients were also measured. Oxybenzone, which has been banned in some places because it may harm coral, was found at average concentrations of 209.6 and 194.9 for the sprays and 169.3 for the lotion. Octocrylene was found at average concentrations of 2.9 and 7.8 for the sprays, 5.7 for the lotion, and 5.7 for the cream. And Camsul was found at average concentrations of 1.5 for the cream. The researchers didn't conclude that people should avoid sunscreen. In fact, the FDA urges its continued use, but they did judge that further studies are needed. Just because something is absorbed doesn't mean it's unsafe, Dr. Michelle said. What it means is you need to ask the next question, what does it do to the body? The FDA's proposed rule was drafted in response to the 2014 Sunscreen Innovation Act, and is expected to be finalized November 26, although manufacturers may be granted additional time to test their ingredients. So far, the industry has requested deferrals for eight chemicals, according to Linda Loretz, chief toxicologist at the Personal Care Products Council, a trade association. Those eight are avobenzone, homosalate, octinoxate, octosalate, octocrylene, oxybenzone, ensulazole, and meretamate. Testing would cost $5 million to $6.34 million for each chemical, according to FDA estimates, or altogether as much as $50.7 million. In comparison, Grandview Research, which provides market information for various industries, estimates the U.S. sun care market size at $1.95 billion in 2016, with sun protection products accounting for 80% of total revenue. It's unclear how much time manufacturers might get to conduct testing, which they plan to do in cooperation with the FDA, but if their ingredients aren't eventually recognized as safe and effective, they'll have to be removed from front sunscreens sold in the U.S. No buts about it. From the Harvard Health Letter, dive into a swimming regimen. Lap swimming offers a total body workout of strengthening, stretching, and aerobic conditioning. When you think of a swimming workout, you may envision an athlete pounding away at the water, racing from one end of the pool to the other, but you don't have to break speed records to reap the rewards of swimming back and forth. And you don't even have to do the competitive swimming stroke known as the crawl. The pace is up to you, and any stroke is fine. Breaststroke, side stroke, and backstroke are often favored because a lot of people don't like putting their face in the water, like you have to do with the crawl, says Lee DeChavis, a physical therapist and clinical supervisor of rehabilitation services at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. She also swam competitively in college. What you get from swimming laps. Lap swimming has many benefits. It's great aerobic activity, the kind to get your heart and lungs pumping, which helps improve your endurance and cardiovascular health and lower your blood pressure. Lap swimming is also great for strengthening muscles. Simply keeping yourself afloat activates the core muscles in your back and abdomen, and you have to move all your muscles to swim. It's a total body workout, DeChavis says. She also points out that the resistance of the water helps maintain muscle strength. In addition, swimming laps offers these features. It relieves joint pain. Your buoyancy in water takes weight off your joints, which causes arthritic joint pain during a workout. It increases flexibility. With each stroke, you reach out a little more and move more than you would in daily activities, and that stretches the muscles, she says. It has a meditative quality. Swimming is a repetitive motion that forces you to focus on your movement and breathing. That helps reduce stress, anxiety, and depression. Even more potential benefits from swimming laps: weight loss, better balance, sharper thinking, and a reduced risk for falls. Swimming risks. Not everyone's a candidate for lap swimming. DeChavis suggests avoiding it if you have an underlying condition such as heart disease or a seizure disorder that puts you at risk for a life-threatening event in the water. You may need to skip lap swimming if you're not strong enough to climb in and out of the pool easily. You should also be careful if you have injuries to your shoulders or neck, as lap swimming may increase your pain. Jumping in. Consider lap swimming if you're generally healthy, you're a good swimmer, and your doctor says it's okay, but start slowly. Focus on the amount of time you spend swimming at first. For example, swim for 5 to 10 minutes a few times per week. Gradually increase the amount of time each week and note how many laps you can do within that time. Eventually, set goals to increase your speed by doing more laps in your set time so that you can measure your progress. Some tips for good practice: warm up with a few minutes of gentle paddling, and then static or long stretches of your shoulder and leg muscles. Use the proper equipment, such as goggles and a bathing cap. If you can, choose a pool that has swimming lanes. Wear non-slip shoes or sandals when walking on the pool deck. Apply sunscreen if you're swimming outdoors. Stay hydrated before and after a workout. And finally, stretch your muscles after lap swimming. You'll want to stay flexible so you can get back in the pool and go for your own gold. Aquatic exercises. If you're not a lap swimmer, you can still benefit from aquatic exercises, exercising in the shallow end of a pool. You might take a class with a trainer who leads a group through a set of exercises with special water weights or flotation devices like pool noodles. Or you can simply try walking. Working against the resistance of the water is good for your muscles and helps you keep flexible. If you have balance problems, it's a good idea to exercise with a friend who can assist you. I also recommend wearing a buoyancy belt around your waist to keep you upright, says Chavis. Look for aquatic exercise classes such as strengthening or aerobics at the local YMCA, a fitness center, or a community center. Closing in on tinnitus treatments. New research aims to capture and eventually cure incessant ringing in the ears. More than 50 million Americans struggle with tinnitus, a constant or recurring ringing in the ears that ranges from irritating to debilitating. Some treatments work for some people, but none seems to work for everybody. Tinnitus is a tough condition for doctors to study. There's no way to measure it directly. The only way we know you have tinnitus is if you tell us. Even if there were a cure, we wouldn't know how it worked because We have to rely on verbal descriptions of what your tinnitus sounds like and how loud it is, says Daniel Polly, director of the Lauer Tinnitus Research Center at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. But Polly and his colleagues are trying to convert tinnitus into a problem that can be measured, which is needed for diagnosis and effective treatment. What's that noise? While some people describe tinnitus as a high-pitched ringing, others say it sounds more like crickets, whooshing or scraping. What is it? Polly says it's a type of feedback that occurs with age. The auditory nerve connecting the ear to the brain starts to fray, diminishing normal sounds. In some people, the brain tries to compensate for this loss of input by turning up internal volume. Polly explains the sensitivity knobs are turned up and now tuned into background sounds in the brain, the same way a microphone picks up the sound of itself when it's too close to a speaker. In rare cases, the noise can be caused by a tumor or cyst pinching the auditory nerve or by a buildup of earwax, making it tangible. Scientists can help you reproduce the sound of your tinnitus so that others understand what you're hearing. Polly and his colleagues have programmed a machine that allows you to control pitch, loudness, and other acoustic features until you feel it matches the sound in your head. But that's not enough to identify tinnitus. Researchers at the Lauer Center are trying to develop a more tangible physical signature of tinnitus. They're using hearing tests as well as measurements of electrical activity in the brain and pupil movement in the eyes. The pupils change size depending on the amount of effort used to listen, and plugging the results into a computer. We're measuring what makes someone with tinnitus different from someone without tinnitus. Then we use artificial intelligence to find a signature that identifies the presence of tinnitus. Our goal is to identify a physical representation of this phantom sound. Eventually, Polly says, computer programs will help scientists understand what changes physically when tinnitus comes and goes. Lauer Center scientists are tackling tinnitus in other ways as well. These researchers have been learning about the underlying biology of the problem. They've been using lab animals to figure out more about the auditory connections lost to age. They're also researching how to regenerate and restore hearing signals from the ear to the brain. Private biotech companies are investigating this approach too. Experimental therapies. Potential tinnitus treatments being studied elsewhere include therapies that aim to zap away tinnitus with tiny amounts of electricity. The idea is to minimize the activity of oversensitive brain cells that turn up the background noise. These experimental therapies, repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, or RTMS, and transcranial direct current stimulation, TDCS, deliver electromagnetic pulses to the scalp, but be careful if you're offered such a treatment. There's no convincing evidence that passing electrical current into your brain is going to make your tinnitus go away. You could make tinnitus worse, Polly cautions. Finally, what works right now? Current treatments attempt to make tinnitus less annoying. For example, cognitive behavior therapy and hypnosis aim to redirect negative thoughts and emotions linked to tinnitus. Sound therapy tries to mask the noise of tinnitus. The masking sound, which comes from wearable or external devices for the ear, is meant to distract overactive brain cells. Maskers are safe and somewhat effective, Polly notes. You pump more signals through the remaining connections between the ear and the brain, and that can temporarily compensate for the lost connections. These therapies only manage symptoms. They don't work for everyone, but they're all we have. Araya hopes for some people, if tinnitus is caused by earwax or a cyst, it can sometimes be eliminated. So talk to your doctor. Otherwise, you won't know what's causing your tinnitus and whether there's anything you can do. Medically tailored meal programs linked to fewer hospital stays, lower costs. As we've reported before, free medically tailored meals are making a big difference for older adults who have chronic illness or are recovering from a hospital stay. The meals are provided by nonprofit agencies and are customized to your dietary needs, like a potassium-controlled diet if you have kidney disease, or a diet low in vitamin K if you're taking a blood thinner. Now, an observational study published online April 22, 2019 by JAMA Network Open suggests that taking part in a free medically tailored meal program is linked to fewer admissions to hospitals and nursing homes, as well as lower medical costs. Researchers looked at about 1,000 adults with health problems such as cancer, diabetes. Half took part in a free medically tailored meal program for about a year. The other half did not. During a two-year follow-up, people who received medically tailored meals had 49% fewer hospital admissions and 72% fewer nursing home admissions than those that did not receive meals. Getting the meals was also tied to a 16% reduction in medical costs each month. To find a program near you, check out the partner section of the Food is Medicine Coalition, and that's www.fimcoalition.org/partners. Walk your dog, break a bone. Owning a dog has many benefits, and a great one is the exercise you get from taking the leash pet for walks. But there's also potential risk for older adults who walk their dogs. Broken bones, according to a study published online March 6, 2019, by JAMA Surgery, researchers who combed through 13 years' worth of data from emergency departments across the United States identified a rising number of fractures among older adults walking leash dogs, 1,700 in 2004, climbing to almost 4,400 in 2017. Most, which is 53% of the bone breaks, were in the upper arm, and 17% were hip fractures. Almost 30% of the patients required hospital admission during the study period, either a large dog, which can knock you down or pull you over, or a small dog, which can get under your feet, can pose a fall risk, especially if you have problems with balance. How can you protect yourself? The authors suggest obedience training can help keep Fido from putting you at risk. What's coming up? What to do when reading gets harder? 4 stretches to keep your shoulders in shape? And extra training for family caregivers. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Let me repeat that because that's new. Our website now is ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Have a great day.